This program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie doke. Welcome back to Media Matters today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, on Sunday, February 29th, 2004. It is a leap year weekend. Once every 4 years, we have this wonderful privilege to have a leap year day. And this is one of the rare times it falls on a weekend. And because of that, WILL-AM Radio, which I have the privilege of broadcasting on, holds every 4 years a special leap year weekend challenge. And this year we're holding it again. And this is aimed for our listeners who just happen to not yet have contributed to WILL, who are not yet members of WILL. If you want to join today, and if you call today, we have a special deal just for people who have not joined yet. And if you do call in today, we have a generous challenge grant made by Tom and Catherine Yancey, who've been friends of WILL for some 3 decades. They will give $29 for every new member who joins today. So if you call today, you'll get an additional $29 added on to your membership. So we do have phone lines open if you'd like to call in and join WILL support programming like you're hearing today in Media Matters with guests like we have today, Molly Ivins. The number 217-244-9455. So please do call in. If you haven't joined WILL, if you've been listening, enjoying this program and other shows on the air, this is your opportunity to sign up and become a member, and you will have your $40 pledge if you do our basic membership matched or raised by another $29 due to the great generosity of Tom and Catherine Yancey. In addition, I might add, if you make a donation during the next hour, during the program Media Matters, I will send you a copy of my brand new book, which literally came off the presses in the last few days. It's called The Problem of the Media, U.S. Communication Politics in the 21st Century, and I just got my first copy of it in my hands yesterday. 367 pages long, a chronicle of the current media situation. If you enjoy this program, I think you'll get a kick out of this book. And so call in, make your pledge, become a member of WILL, call 217-244-9455. Make your $40 pledge. It'll be matched by $29 or upped by $29 by Tom and Catherine Yancey through their generosity. And we will send you a copy at no charge of my brand new book, Robert W. McChesney, author, The Problem of the Media. So please do that. I'll get back to this and make the same pitch a couple more times in the show. But this is not a pledge drive show. This is a standard Media Matters. And we're really privileged today to have one of the people I've wanted to have on this program since we started it nearly 2 years ago, the nationally syndicated political columnist Molly Ivins, author of many books, including the new bestseller, Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. Molly, are you there?
I am.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be with you, Bob.
It's really a pleasure to have you. And I think that you you write for The Progressive magazine, and I know a lot of our listeners are regular readers of The Progressive. We've had Matt Rothschild from The Progressive on the program. And in the new issue of The Progressive, you have a column about our fair president, who you know quite a bit about, George W. Bush. And in that column, you suggest he might not have the gray matter to do the job. Could you elaborate on that for us?
Oh, well, gosh, I guess this is an old and by now rather tiresome argument. I don't think Bush is stupid. I don't think he's mean. I've known him since we were in high school. But he's just very limited. It sounds so intellectually snobby to say that's not a first-rate mind. But it's really striking, as you notice in the Paul O'Neill memoir, where the former Treasury Secretary is quoted as saying what a striking lack of curiosity there is about Bush. And when we watched him as governor down here in Texas for 6 years, it was very clear that he's just not interested in governance. He doesn't like to read. He doesn't like meetings. He doesn't like memos. And what I always think, it's a very Midland state of mind. Midland, Texas, bless its heart. Stuck way out there in the middle of West Texas, which is pretty much the middle of nowhere, with only Odessa for company, its twin sister city. If you, for example, go to the dinner at the Midland Petroleum Club with a bunch of oil men, you'll come away saying to yourself, gosh, what a swell bunch of fellows. Thank God they're not running the world. And that's sort of the way I always feel about W. It's not... He's not stupid, he's not cruel, he's just very limited. Very Texan, I might add. I always think those three strains of Texas culture that you see in him constantly, anti-intellectualism, religiosity, and which is the display of religious belief, and the machismo of Texas males.
The bring it on, George W. Bush.
Yeah.
Well, what does move George W. Bush, if not politics? If he isn't a Clinton type who really revels in the stuff of politics, what pushes his buttons? What gets
well,
him?
Well, Clinton was... There are a lot of politicians who are interested in the political side of politics, and George W. is, and furthermore, he's quite good at it. That's not the same thing as being interested in governance.
Mm-hmm.
Clinton was an unusual politician in that... he was very, very good at the political side of politics, the getting elected side, but he was also interested in governance. I mean, he really was a policy wonk. I think policy bores Bush.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Molly Ivins today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Molly Ivins, nationally syndicated columnist, writes for the Progressive Magazine, and is the author of the new book with Lou DeBose, Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. And I think it's safe to say, Molly, you are one of the reigning experts on George W. Bush, if that's an honor you want to have.
Well, you know, I didn't set out to be. It's kind of like that fellow said when they asked him why he climbed Mount Everest. It was there. I mean, there he was. There was nothing I could do about it.
If you'd like to call in and ask a question to Molly Ivins, the phone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And as a reminder for those who weren't here at the top of the show a few minutes ago, this is the leap year weekend. We're having a special challenge grant for people who are not yet members of WILL. If you call in and make your $40 pledge, it will be matched through the generosity of Tom and Catherine Yancey for another $29. I guess not matched, but upped, $29. And my brand new book, which literally just came off the press a few days ago, The Problem of the Media, we will send you a copy. Anyone who joins up who's not yet a member, just call in today. And unfortunately, and I don't mean to confuse you, listeners, you don't call the same number to make the pledge that you call to ask Molly Ivins a question. If you want to call to join up and make the $40 pledge, the number is 217-244-9455. Or you can do it online at the University of Illinois website, uiuc.edu. No, will.uiuc.edu. Again, the number's here if you want to talk to Molly Ivins, 333-9455, and toll-free 1-800-222-9455. And Molly, I've got news for you.
Yeah.
You've set the all-time Media Matters record. We've filled up our phone bank already.
I love it.
Yeah, it's just
true. Well, I'm always especially happy to talk to pledgers. Let me tell you, here, this once-in-a-blue-moon offer you've got with this leap year deal, that sounds like a dandy thing.
Well, coming from a Texan, that's really an honor.
Well, now, I'll tell you how I feel about this pledging there to your public radio. My theory is that I never give any money to any outfit, the head of which makes more money than I do. And the great thing about the people at public radio is that you know they are not wasting your money on overhead. I mean, these poor people who work there at the public radio station, you should see them. Just skinny with hunger, they get all their clothes at the St. Vincent de Paul. Little bellies all swollen from hunger, little stick-like legs, great big eyes. I'm telling you, it's a y'all. Don't worry about it. These people need the money more than you do.
Well, thank you, Molly. That's a terrific pitch. So everyone, you've heard her, call in, and you get a copy of my book to boot. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 4, Eureka, you're on the air with Molly Ivins.
Well, thank you. It's a real privilege to speak with you, Molly. You're a breath of fresh air. Could I ask two short questions, please?
Sure.
And maybe you partially answered, but to me, it's frightening the number of people who seem to find credibility in George W. Bush. And I guess I sort of scratch my brain to figure out why. What might you suggest are the reasons that he seems to have a fairly widespread believability?
Well, I really feel that, he was elected, if at all, by the skin of his teeth. And I think people regarded him properly with some skepticism, and then along came 9/11, and that really did unite the country. Mm-hmm. And, in a situation like that, you get behind the president. As Lyndon Johnson used to remind us, he's the only president we've got. Mm-hmm. And so people said, well, here we are, patriotic time to support the country. Let's just throw in behind the president. His leader will follow. And I think people just cut him an enormous amount of slack. And I think that continued. I mean, you always rally in times of danger and war. And there we were. We went from Vietnam, sort of pitched ourselves into Iraq before anybody had a whole lot of time to think about it. And now I think you see a lot of people sort of scratching their heads and going, now, wait a minute. What happened to those weapons and all that? And, you know, there's an extent to which, you know, things change. But I really do think that there is a profound uneasiness in the country right now about Bush. And it's partly Iraq, but it's also... my theory of politics is that we need to pay more less attention to Dow Jones and more attention to Doug Jones, average American. And basically, Doug Jones is not doing well here. Doug Jones, in fact, is getting screwed, is what's happening. And it's not just the lost jobs, 2.3 million lost jobs. It's people are losing their health insurance. The price of health insurance doubles, triples. People are losing their pension rights. People are losing their overtime. I mean, this is just not working for an awful lot of people. And, you know, here the guy just sits and says, what we need is more tax cuts for the rich. I mean, it's nutty. Mm-hmm.
Caller, anything else you'd like to ask?
Yes, in your book, I read two or three chapters. I read the one on religious, George Bush and his own idea of religiosity, because I'm interested in that field. But what frightened me was the number of times that he seemed to put different social agencies into hands of people that were totally and completely not just inept, but cruel and horrible. Could you elaborate?
Yeah, that's been a real problem. We're 5 years now in Texas into the so-called faith-based initiative, where we turn social services over to religious institutions. And the trouble is that there's no vetting procedure. In other words, we're giving public money to people who may be frauds, incompetents, or in some cases, very sick citizens. Mm-hmm. And because Bush was so determined that, you know, government regulation is bad, and government is bad, and no more forms, and no more checks, and all this regulation that he hates, well, then... the result, of course, has been just some disastrous misallocations of public money in this state.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. We're talking to Molly Ivins today, our guest on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Molly Ivins, the nationally syndicated columnist, known for her political humor and her insight, is also the author of the new book with Lou DeBose, Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. Phone number here, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Molly Ivins.
Yeah, I've been reading your columns for years and think you're wonderful fresh air, breath of fresh air on the political landscape. The question is this. You and other people have been writing these stories about Bush's limited mentality, how little he did as governor, the Air Guard fiasco, his corrupt business dealings, for years now, over a decade. Why haven't these stories taken? Why hasn't the press run with them? Why don't Americans care?
Well, there you have a series of very good questions, and they're related, but I'm not sure there is one single answer. It seemed to me that Bush got an extraordinarily light ride during the 2000 campaign. I mean, as somebody who had watched him as governor, who knew how limited he is, I was very, very uneasy with what seemed to me extremely uneven treatment of the candidates in 2000. Now, granted that Al Gore's a stiff, but even so, I was just amazed by the extent to which Al Gore would say something that was actually true, you know, like, you know, they modeled a guy in Love Story on him, or that he was one of the early players in the forerunner of the Internet. In fact, that was true. And the whole storyline became Al Gore exaggerates, Al Gore fibs. Meanwhile, there's George W. Bush down one whopper after another. I mean, it was just mind-boggling. I mean, if you knew anything about his record, to stand there and hear him claim that he was the father of the Texas Patients Bill of Rights, I almost threw up. He vetoed it. And then when they passed it over his veto, he refused to sign it. He hated the bill so much. I mean, there were things like that that were just inexcusable. But I go back to the idea that after 9/11, people, the media stopped criticizing Bush. because it was really felt that it was unpatriotic. And then, of course, we realized after a long time that they had run this patriotism string way past the point of what's permissible. I mean, you know, the one that I remember was Ari Fleischer, Bush's previous press spokesman, when he made the landing, the infamous landing on the aircraft carrier, the mission accomplished photo op. Ari Fleischer turned to the press, which was questioning all this, and said, "Well, whatever way the president, whatever the president did, is the right and proper thing." Well, that's so silly. I mean, the idea that you'd be somehow questioning an American president is unpatriotic. And they really have run that string way past the point where it can hold.
Molly, what do you think is going to happen with this National Guard story? Is this going to continue on, or is this going to be successfully sort of swept under the rug?
Well, I'm amazed that it came up again, frankly. I mean, we had known about it, and, you know, it was so obvious. If you know the Texas unit at all, it was the reason Ann Richards didn't go after it is because there were so many sons of prominent Democrats in that same unit, the so-called Champagne unit. Of the National Guard, and of course you got in by knowing people and pulling strings, and there's no question at all that that's exactly how he got in.
But that's not really the controversy here anymore. I guess
whether he actually served.
Yeah, rich people are allowed to skip military service. That doesn't disqualify you anymore, I guess, from high office. It's rather whether you even served the country club route.
Yeah, well, he may simply have been AWOL for about 18 months there. I mean, nobody's... They keep saying they've released the records showing that he was in Alabama, you know, he did service in Alabama, but absolutely there aren't any records. That isn't what the records show.
And this is
so we still have some missing time in there.
Yeah.
That, I think, is, again, that wasn't that unusual, that guys would just dog out the end of their National Guard commitment.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Molly Ivins today in Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line two, you're on the air with Molly Ivins.
Yes, good afternoon. You have an article out on Alternet recently about the Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae situation, and that looks like a really big story that I was hoping you could discuss a little bit about that.
Well, of course, if you want to scare yourself to death, this is a real good one to look at. I mean, who needs to go to horror movies? All we have to do is look at some of the stuff that's going wrong with government. These two enormous mortgage companies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are private companies, but they're also what are called government-sponsored entities. A GSE is the jargon for it. Isn't that charming? And what has happened is that they have simply gotten in terrible debt. These two mortgage companies between them will shortly have a total debt greater than that of the national government. It's running about $2 trillion right now. If they go under, which they might, we assume that the taxpayers are on the hook for it. And what that means is that we are just facing a calamitous increase in the national debt. It cost the taxpayers $500 billion to bail out the SNLs, which is one of those stupid deregulation moves. The reason nobody ever, the reason most people don't understand that whole SNL thing was completely unnecessary and a perfect example of how government gets bought by a special interest is because both parties were complicit in passing the legislation that set up the SNL disaster. Now both parties are complicit in not doing anything as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, these two mortgage companies, just spiral out of control. And if you really wanted to scare yourself, kind of like telling ghost stories around the campfire, you know, a really scary thing could happen, the fact is that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have tried to protect themselves from their increasing risk by going through hedge funds, which are themselves completely unregulated. And if a major, major financial disaster like the collapse of these two enormous mortgage companies, which together hold something like 3/4 of all home mortgages in this country, You may not have gotten your home mortgage through either of these agencies. You may have gone through a private institution, but what happens is these two mortgage companies go around and buy up mortgages from other companies and then package them as financial instruments. It's kind of a complicated financial ploy, but basically they probably own your mortgage. And if they go under and take a bunch of hedge funds with them, well, there you have colossal world depression and things will be really terrible. How's that for a cheerful scenario?
Well, Molly, is there what can folks do or concerned about? Is this?
Yes, well, there is something that can be done, and basically the point is to get people off the dime. We watched this potential horror developing for over a year now. People who know about this kind of thing have been screaming about it. Those of you who read the business pages will recognize it. And once again, Congress, which gets a lot of money because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are private institutions, they spend an enormous amount of money lobbying on Capitol Hill. They have an enormous public relations campaign to convince people that they're the good guys who make it possible for most Americans to buy homes. And Congress is over-influenced by this particular special interest, just as it is on so many other special interest issues. Even Alan Greenspan, who, as you know, is the great financial poobah, and who, you know, just sort of mutters obscurely about things that are going on, said something when he testified in front of the Senate Banking Committee last week, which the Wall Street Journal translated as, "Do something fast."
All right. Well, we're talking to Molly Ivins. She's our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Molly is the nationally known syndicated columnist and also the author of the new book with Lou DeBose, Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. We have a full bank of phone lines and phone callers, and we're going to get to all of you. I make that promise. I do want to let folks know that this is a special leap year weekend. Every 4 years we do this. If you have not joined WILL, you've never contributed, this is a special offer we have. Thanks to Tom and Catherine Yancey. They will up any $40 pledge by $29 if you join today. In addition, if you join during the next hour and let folks know you're calling during Media Matters, I will send you a copy of my brand new book, The Problem of the Media. The number to call is 217-244-9455. Please call if you haven't joined. We need your support. Public radio depends upon it. Shows like this depend upon it. And I don't want to have to keep making sales pitches, so just call up that line and then call up the other number and talk to Molly Ivins at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455, our toll-free number. Right now, let's go back to the phone lines. The people have been waiting patiently. Hello, you're on the air with Molly Ivins.
Hi. I have a question, and I love your books, by the way. What do you think of the probability of Ken Lay getting what's supposed to be coming to him as a result of all his the way he handled Enron? I mean, we see that Jeffrey Skilling is
right
on the hooks now, but there's
right
so much tie-in with Ken Lay and Bush that it's amazing that nobody's saying anything more about that. And I'll hang up.
Yeah, that is the general impression so far, is that despite early skepticism, oh, good, they're going to nail a bunch of little guys and let the big fish get away again, that actually this has been a really classically well-done prosecution. They're just going up the chain, up the chain, up the chain. I will tell you that I'm impressed that they got as far as Jeff Skilling's. And I don't know whether they can get to Ken Lay or not. But I will tell you that it is impressive that they've got as far as Jeff Skilling's, and I think they can convict him. And that, to me, knowing the story of Enron, I think Skilling's may have been far more the arch villain in the Enron story than Ken Lay ever was. Now, I don't know enough. I mean, I wasn't really there to, you know, I've read a couple of books about it. I've talked to a lot of people about it, but I'm not sure anybody knows exactly how culpable Ken Lay was, exactly how much he knew and understood about the advanced financial shenanigans that Skilling's was orchestrating. And it's a little hard with Ken Lay, who always, as a friend said, smiled and smiled all the time, smiling like a possum. it's a little hard to say if he was real clued in. I know that sounds absurd since it was his company, but he was sort of busy being chairman of the board and running around, you know, going to baseball games with George W., and it was Skillings who was pretty much running the show. So I don't know whether they're going to get Lay or not. If there is something that makes you just want to, I don't know, kind of, it makes me very angry, I guess. I mean, there's recognizing an emotion. To think that Ken Lay might walk away with his millions after all those people were ruined and their lives really were shattered.
You know, Molly, a couple of years ago, and you wrote about this in your column, and I quote it in the new book, in fact, that I just wrote, George W. Bush and Cheney both sort of pronounced their concern about this corporate crime wave with Enron and WorldCom and all these other firms, Arthur Andersen, and announced they weren't going to stand for this anymore, and they'd implement reforms to prevent shareholders and workers and consumers from getting defrauded. How successful was the George W. Bush campaign against corporate crime?
Well, I think we said in our book, you know, the guy is a conscientious objector in his own war on corporate crime. I mean, basically, Bush's little company, Harkin, was a minor miniature Enron. I mean, they did at Harkin practically everything that was done at Enron, but it was a much smaller company, and they did it on a much smaller scale. And for Bush to stand up, the sheer hypocrisy of that moment was just breathtaking. And I must say, I think there is some progress that has been made, the Sarbanes-Oxley bill, but the key is funding the SEC, funding the regulators. What's happened again and again is that corporate special interests come in and say, oh, we hate regulation. And if the Congress doesn't actually deregulate any given industry, then what they do is underfund the regulators so that effectively they undermine regulation. And this has been going on at various government agencies for over 10 years now.
Yeah, I'm reminded that when George W. Bush made some of his thunderous pronouncements a couple of years ago on the heels of the Enron scandal, the Financial Times headline, you might be familiar with this, said George W. Bush proposes to outlaw what he did to get rich.
Exactly.
We're talking to Molly Ivins today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The number here, if you'd like to call in and ask Molly Ivins a question, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Molly Ivins.
Yeah, thank you. I have a quick comment and a question. The comment is, I saw Molly at the Conference of World Affairs in Boulder about 5 years ago, I guess, and she was just great, and it's a shame Boulder is getting such bad press, as I don't see too many universities, in particular Illinois universities, hosting such an affair. It was really great. But I've got a question for you, and it's about the Enron stock market bubble kind of thing that you were talking about just now. And why isn't anybody talking about the way that whole thing has a lot to do with a sort of it's kind of hard to find the words, kind of an overclass kind of ethnic domination thing going, because CEOs are overwhelmingly white, male, and WASP, and nobody seems to talk about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. We've always been aware that the corporate world was sort of the last bastion of WASP dominance. What's really bizarre, and I think this goes to several pieces of deregulation along the way. If you look at Enron, I mean, some of that got set up as long ago as 92, when Wendy Graham, Senator Phil Graham's wife, made some questionable regulatory decisions. And then, of course, as soon as she left the regulatory agency, she went on the board of Enron. And this kind of open corruption, it's what's really creepy is how acceptable it is, this sort of legalized bribery, this idea that, you know, government exists to serve the interests of private corporations because they buy congressional votes through campaign donations. I mean, What we need is for people not just to get mad about it. It's not that people don't know. I've talked to people all over the country. They understand that campaign contributions buy special influence, and that if you're just an average American, you're not going to get the same consideration from your own elected representatives that some big campaign donor does. I mean, people aren't fools. They know that. The question is, they think the problem is they think there's nothing that they can do about it. And that's where I think so many people are wrong. I think this thing is fixable. And furthermore, I think we have an obligation to fix it, in addition to it being in our self-interest. So I'm convinced that public campaign financing and furthermore just general hell-raising can stop some of the worst of these decisions, but they are in toto having a truly degrading effect on both the quality of life and the economy in this country.
Molly, what's your take of the field of candidates running for president on the Democratic side right now trying to challenge George W. Bush in the fall?
Well, here the field seems to be dramatically narrowed to two.
Yeah.
I was leaning Dean myself, and it's been an exciting and really fascinating race. I tend to be more optimistic than most people. I think the pose of cynicism, you know, oh, God, politics, they're all crooked. I actually think it's been a terrific race, and I'm kind of sorry to see that old Kerry, who was the early favorite and is kind of the Democratic establishment guy, looks like he's coming out on top here. My problem with Kerry is, of course, that he's got no Elvis. He's at minus zero on the Elvis scale, which is something I invented myself. My theory is that it's real hard to get elected if you have no Elvis.
And Clinton, of course, did pretty well on the Elvis scale.
Oh, Clinton was about a 9 there on the Elvis scale. Clinton was way up there.
What about W?
He's got a touch of Elvis every now and again.
How about Dukakis?
1-2. Oh, Dukakis minus 0 on the Elvis scale. That's my problem with Kerry. I think he's a tall Dukakis. My problem with Kerry is that he's a boring stiff. I mean, there's nothing wrong with him. He's a serious guy. He's a boring stiff with gravitas. Okay, he's got gravitas. He's got this great background. But, you know, it's painful to listen to a speech. Now, the trouble with criticizing any of the Democratic candidates is you always have to say, compared to what? I mean, is it interesting to listen to George W. Bush make a speech? Hell no. I mean, he's a dreadful public speaker. The only fun thing you get with Bush is that every now and again he comes out with one of these Bushisms, which are, of course, just great fun, where he gets so hopelessly tangled up in the English language he can't make it through an entire sentence. And that's always an exciting moment for those of us who listen to politicians. But aside from that, no, Bush is also a boring stiff. So Kerry doesn't really, you know, he doesn't have to be real sexy to come out ahead on that one.
Do you think a guy like Kerry can go down and win any of the southern states or Texas?
His southern appeal would be the war record. In the South, we still like war heroes. And that would have a lot of appeal.
Mm-hmm.
He's a serious guy. As they say, he looks presidential.
Mm-hmm.
I always like it when Jon Stewart of The Daily Show puts up a picture of him and says, "Why the long face?" It's pretty funny, Bob.
Okay. We're talking to Molly Ivins today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a full bank of phone callers who are waiting to talk to Molly, and we're going to get to all of them. I make that promise to you. So let's go right back to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Danville, you're on the air with Molly Ivins.
Hello to both of you. I have a question about Bush and his wife. I know he doesn't read, has no cultural interests. It's my understanding he had never even left the country but once until last year. And I think his wife's a librarian. That's what I was told. And everybody knows Printers, Inc. runs through librarians' veins. And I can't understand the match and why they've been together so long and he hasn't changed. Does he have her in a trance or something?
Bless your heart. Well, as we all know, other people's marriages are a source of eternal mystery. I like Laura Bush. I think she's a real person, and I'm not sure why she's stayed with him. She must like him. As I say, he's not an actively bad fellow. Yes, she, of course, is much more of a reader than he is, and she, her interest in literacy and literature is quite genuine. One of the saddest things I know about that relationship, is, and as far as I know, it's a perfectly good marriage, is that Bush used to tell the story, you know, he's sort of dyslexic emotionally as well as verbally, that when he was courting Laura and proposed to her in Midland, she accepted his proposal, but she said, "I have one condition. Promise me that I'll never have to make a political speech," because she's very shy. And, of course, the poor woman has had to make thousands of political speeches by now, and Bush would tell that story and then grin and always say, "I sure am glad she broke that promise." She broke that promise. Isn't that funny?
Yeah. All right, well, let's go back to the phone lines if we can. Line 2, Champaign, you're on the air with Molly Ivins. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air with Molly Ivins.
Oh. I wanted to come back to the issue of Bushisms.
Yeah.
Early on in his presidency and in his first campaign, I mean, it was delightful. It was as good as the good old days of the old Mayor Daley. But lately, there seems to be actually improvement in his speaking ability. Am I simply...
Oh, no, let me tell you what they're doing. This is really fascinating. The White House not only edits the transcripts now before they release them, they take out the Bushisms. When they actually edit the videotape to take out the errs and the ums, there was let out their own version of Tim Russert's interview with Bush on Meet the Press a couple of weeks ago.
Yum.
When, as you recall, if you saw it, he was sort of flummoxed several times and had trouble scraping together an answer. They edited it to take out all the They're making him look smarter any way they can. No, he's still coming out with Bushisms. There's a new collection out by that guy, Jacob Weisberg, collects the Bushisms, and there's a new edition coming out.
I'll have to look for it. Thanks.
Yeah.
We're talking to Molly Ivins today on Media Matters. Molly Ivins is the nationally syndicated columnist, and she's the author of the new book, along with Lou DeBose, Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America.
Bob, you're an expert on media. Don't you think that's a sort of new wrinkle that they're managing to clean up his words as he goes?
I've never heard of that before. I mean, certainly print copy, that goes back century, that you would clean up print copy,
right.
Congressional talk or something from Congressional Record. But yeah, to go into video or audio and edit it and then release it and not acknowledge that you basically doctored it.
Right.
I've never heard of that before.
Here we are, yet another advance in Orwellian world.
It's quite striking. And while I've got everyone on the horn listening up, let me tell you again, this is Leap Year Weekend, and every 4 years we have a special Leap Year Challenge here at WILL, public radio in East Central Illinois. And Tom and Catherine Yancey, who have been friends of WILL for 3 decades, have very generously... to celebrate Catherine's leap year birthday today, offered to make a $29 contribution for every person who becomes a new friend of WILL this weekend, either by phone or online. And you can call here. I've given the number before. I'll give it again. It's 217-244-9455. That's 244-9455. Make the $40 pledge or more. They'll top it with another $29, and I will send you, if you call during this hour, during Media Matters, a copy of my brand new book, The Problem of the Media. You can also go to WILL.UIUC.edu and contribute online at the secure website. Please do, if you're not a member of WILL, if you've been listening to shows like this one, to people like Molly Ivins with an opportunity to talk uninterrupted without a lot of commercials pestering you, and you're enjoying this type of programming, we need your support. We desperately need it. If you're not a member, please join. I think you'll be delighted you did. You'll feel good when you're done. You get a copy of a book, and you know you're helping keep radio like this, advertising-free radio, alive and well in Illinois and across the nation. You're listening to WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, you're on the air with Molly Ivins.
Yeah, hello, Ms. Ivins. And anyway, I just wanted to say a couple of things. Number one, Kerry kind of reminds me more of Ed Muskie, another one-time front runner for that nomination. And anyway, I thought for laughs you might want to check out a British writer named David Icke.
Mm-hmm.
He has this interesting theory that the Bush family is part of a basically all civilization long cabal of shape-shifting alien lizards.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
I love it. Great conspiracy theory.
Anyway, it's a lot of fun. He does have a book out with a lot of information on 911, though, called Alice in Wonderland and the World Trade Center Disasters.
So. Well, you know, I'm an anti-conspiracy theorist. I don't believe in conspiracy theories. I don't believe there are any. And if there are, somebody always gets drunk and spills the beans. So we don't need to worry about it. What's creepy is not, you know, that there's some secret conspiracy going on, but how much of this is just all out there? I mean, there's no secret at all. You know, that the right wing is organized to take over media and influence media. I mean, none of this is a cabal of any kind. It's all public record.
You know, Molly, one of the issues that's really right out there, too, that's not a conspiracy, is this whole gerrymandering question of electoral districts in the United States, both at the state and at the congressional level. And the New York Times had an eloquent editorial against the practice roughly a week ago. The Economist magazine, the British business publication, has a great line where it says, in most democracies, voters pick their representatives. In the United States, representatives pick their voters. And, you know, we have a situation now where only a small percentage of our seats for the U.S. House of Representatives are contested anymore.
Exactly. But yeah, that's one of those things where you talk to people about it, and they say, yeah, but what can I do?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there is something we can do. In Iowa, they have redistricting done not by the politicians, but by an independent commission. And the result is that Iowa, which has five congressional districts, four of them are competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And they could be won by one side or the other. And, you know, really most of us are essentially denied an opportunity to vote in a race where our vote can make the difference in a serious way because the districts are so gerrymandered.
And what's happening? You know, Texas got a lot of attention in the past year or so about what's going on down there with the redistricting fight, because this seems to be part and parcel of what we're talking about. What is taking place in Texas with regard to redistricting those congressional seats?
Well, I'm sorry to say that Tom DeLay, the House Majority Leader, won that fight. You know, there's a tendency when redistricting fights come up to say, well, the other side always does it when they have power. And that's pretty much true. I mean, I'd have to say somebody who's watched politics, yeah. But that doesn't make it right. It's one of those things, well, if they're both wrong, it still doesn't make it a good thing. And what DeLay and the Republicans did on gaining control of the Texas legislature was to take the unfair gerrymandering practices and push them to an extent that was really just astonishing. And it was so bad that the Democrats revolted and fled the state in order to bust a quorum. You can tell they were serious about it because they fled to Ardmore, Oklahoma. And I'm here to tell y'all that Ardmore is not a destination vacation spot.
But unfortunately, how many House seats does Texas have, districts?
Let's see. We had 17 and 15, however many that makes.
32. And so even though Texas might vote like 53%, 47 Republicans, say, in actual votes, it's going to be overwhelmingly Republican seats in the U.S. Congress. Is that right?
Yeah, and the Republicans had a point. The state votes Republican statewide. But the fact is that the old congressional Democrats were there because Republicans liked them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was Republican votes that elected those guys.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we're talking to Molly Ivins today, Media Matters. We've only got about 7 or 8 minutes left, and we've got a couple of callers who've been very patient. So let's go to the phone lines. Tuscola, you're on the air with Molly Ivins.
Hello.
Hello. You're on.
Yes. First, Molly, I want to say hi, and I love listening to you and Jim Hightower. We the whole family just loves it. Keep up the good work. My question is, what's your take on the DeVolt voting machines? I believe they say in 30 states now. To me and my family, that's very scary.
Yeah. Well, again, you don't want to get into conspiracy stuff here. On the other hand,
I think you'd have to be a damn fool not to be concerned about this. The man who makes these Diebold voting machines out of Ohio is a Bush pioneer. He's raised $100,000 for Bush, and actually sent out a letter saying that he would do anything to make sure that Bush carried Ohio next year. Well, this is the guy who makes the voting machines. I mean, does that give you any sense of reassurance that that there could possibly be nothing wrong here? And the ways you can rig voting machines, I'm sorry to say, I don't know, I'm not that familiar with the technical details. But journalists like Ronnie Duggar, who've been studying this for years, say that it's very, very easy to rig them, to, you know, miscount an occasional vote and lose votes. And so the way you want to do it is to have a paper trail. And I don't see why in Canada, they where they do lots of things intelligently, they all seem to be able to vote across the country in short order and have their votes counted and with a paper trail, and there's no difficulty in doing it. Yeah, I'm, you know, in our usual confused patchwork way that we do things, in most states, voting machines are bought by county officials. And, of course, there you get into the fact that the people who make the voting machines will take the county officials out to dinner, jump drinks and a good time, and you get a little lobbying going on and blah, blah, blah. So I really think this is one of those things where citizens need to be alert. And the great thing about fair election rules is that what goes around comes around in elections, so that it's the fairest way to do it is good for both sides.
We're talking to Molly Ivins today in Media Matters. We've only got a few minutes left. And before we go back to our next caller, Molly, I just wanted to ask you, you know, I really like your optimism and your enthusiasm, despite what is oftentimes a pretty grim picture that you paint. Who are the politicians, the people in public life over the years that you've admired? I mean, who do you look to give you hope that, you know, public life can be a positive part of the American
experience? Oh, I've had lots of heroes in politics. And it's always best to wait until they're dead, as I've observed many times. but dead or retired, either one will do. Of course, there are lots of them, and extraordinarily decent people in politics. I mean, speaking of the dead, Paul Wellstone was a great hero of mine. Dale Bumpers, retired senator from Arkansas. Ralph Yarborough, great populist senator from Texas. In the legislature, I've had lots of them, lots of heroes. And the people nobody beyond our state ever heard of, and not many people in our state ever heard of. But these are public servants who, out of a sense of responsibility and civic duty, come down and devote years on end to solving difficult issues of public life, like how to fund the public schools fairly. I mean, that's one that you can work on for years and just make a little bit of a contribution toward improving it, and that will make a real difference in kids' lives. And I see that kind of public service all the time.
That's terrific. We've got one more caller I want to get to today. Line 2, Champaign, you're on the air with Molly Ivins.
Yes, good afternoon, Ms. Ivins. It's really an honor to be talking to you. On a personal level, I'd like to say that I have a sister-in-law, a really intelligent sister-in-law in her very early 50s, which got an amazing physical resemblance to you, and that makes our family gathering very funny, sort of thing. And my question is, I feel while the rank and file of the organized labor knows what's happening to them by mostly Republican administration, looks like the people who are on the field, the real blue-collar worker who got to vote, they do not see it. And among them, a lot of them are solid Republicans, you know, NRA members or what have you, and when it comes to deliver the vote, they do not see it actually what's happening to them, and the votes are not there.
Well, it's interesting to watch people vote against their own economic interest, which we've seen quite a bit of. We see certainly more common now than it was back when people had vivid memories of the Depression. And a lot of that is deliberate misdirection to use social issues as wedge issues. Of course, in the South, the classic game was to, you know, make whites angry at blacks and make people, you know, Lyndon Johnson said when he signed the Civil Rights Bill that it was going to cost the Democrats the South and it was going to take two generations, and he was right on both counts. And the classic way to split Southerners, of course, was by race. Then you find wedge issues like abortion and now gay marriage, the new fashionable one. And the funny thing is that when you run for public office and you take an oath, you swear to uphold the laws in the Constitution. You don't swear to uphold the Bible. That's not what you're elected for. That's somebody. That's the business of people who are preachers, ministers, and priests and rabbis. That's not what public officials are for. I'm not saying that there is no moral content to political leadership. Of course there is. But I think we constantly get confused, and I know we're deliberately misled. It's a lot of it is like you got to keep your eye on this shell with the pea under it. What really the real questions in politics, I think, are who's getting screwed and who's doing the screwing. And then somebody added another one, which is what the hell will they do to us next? The fact is that while people, you know, run around making you think that gay marriage is some big deal and the most important issue in the world, there's all kind of, you know, there's just this staggering unfairness in terms of the way people are treated in terms of tax fairness. You know, it's a question of who pays and who gets what. And what we see more and more is that the entire tax burden is being moved away from corporations, corporate special interests, which can buy influence, and more onto the shoulders of ordinary Americans. And when you get 45% of these huge tax breaks given by Bush going to the richest 1% of the people in this country, these were not people who needed a tax break to begin with. I think the whole thing is just reaching a point of being obscenely out of whack.
Well, you know, Molly, on that note, I hear the band tuning up in the background.
There we are.
Yeah, I want to thank Molly Ivins for joining us today on Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. Be sure to look for Molly Ivins' new book she wrote with Lou DeBose, Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. Molly, thank you so much for joining
us. Okay, well, y'all don't forget to laugh, too, okay?
Yeah, that's right. And if you read Molly's books, you will laugh, I guarantee it. And I'd also like to remind our listeners that this is the special Leap Year Pledge, and if you haven't called yet to join and become a member of WILL, be sure to do that right now, 244-9455, or go online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Tom and Catherine Yancey will match your pledge, or they'll add another $29 onto it if you make a $40 basic pledge, and you get a free copy of my brand new book, The Problem of the Media. My name is Bob McChesney. I want to thank Victor Picard, my producer. I'll be back a week from today with Chuck Lewis from Center for Public Integrity. Ciao.
New friends are important to the future of WILL because as costs continue to rise and funds from tax-based sources decline, contributions from the same number of friends can't cover the gap. Our goal this weekend is to encourage you, if you're not now a contributing friend of WILL, to come on board with a basic membership gift of $40 or more. Please call 217-244-9455 with your gift right now. Thanks for supporting WILL Urbana.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with a high around 60 degrees and south winds 15 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, showers and thunderstorms likely, the low in the mid-40s with southeast winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, breezy with thunderstorms likely, the high in the mid-60s with south winds 15 to 25 miles per hour. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.